The military mentality is a bandit and raider mentality. Thus, all military represents a form of organized banditry where the conventional mores do not prevail. The military is a way of rationalizing murder, rape, looting, and other forms of theft, which are always accepted as part of warfare. When denied an outside target, the military mentality always turns against its own civilian population, using identical rationalizations for bandit behavior. USAB Manual, Chapter 5, The Warlord Syndrome. McKee, awakening from the communications trance, realized how he must have appeared to this strange Gowichan towering over him. Of course a Dosadi Gowichan would think him ill. He'd been shivering and mumbling in the trance, perspiration rolling from him. McKee took a deep breath. "No, I'm not ill." "Then it's an addiction." Recalling the many substances to which the Dosadi could be addicted, McKee almost used this excuse, but thought better of it. This Gowichan might demand some of the addictive substance. "Not an addiction," McKee said. He lifted himself to his feet, glanced around. The sun had moved perceptibly toward the horizon behind its streaming veil. And something new had been added to the landscape. That gigantic tracked vehicle, which stood throbbing and puffing smoke from a vertical stack behind the Gowichan intruder. The Gowichan maintained a steady, intense concentration on McKee, disconcerting in its unwavering directness. McKee had to ask himself, was this some threat, or his Dosadi contact? Derich's people had said a vehicle would be sent to the contact point, but not ill, not an addiction, the Gowichan said. Is it some strange condition which only humans have? I was ill, McKee said, but I'm recovered. The condition has passed. Do you often have such attacks? I can go years without a recurrence. Years? What causes this condition? I don't know. The Gowichan nodded, gestured upward with his chin. An affliction of the gods, perhaps. Perhaps. You were completely vulnerable. McKee shrugged. Let the Gowichan make of that what he could. You were not vulnerable. Somehow this amused the Gowichan, who added, I am Barank. Perhaps that's the luckiest thing which has ever happened to you. Barank was the name Erich's aides had given as McKee's first contact. I am McKee. You fit the description, McKee. Except for your, condition. Do you wish to say more? McKee wondered what Barank expected. This was supposed to be a simple contact handing him on to more important people. Erich was certain to have knowledgeable observers on Dosadi, but Barank was not supposed to be one of them. The warning about this Gowichan had been specific. Barank doesn't know about us. Be extremely careful what you reveal to him. It'd be very dangerous to you if he were to learn that you came from beyond the God Veil. The jump door aides had reinforced the warning. If the Dosadi penetrate your cover, you'll have to return to your pickup point on your own. We very much doubt that you could make it. Understand that we can give you little help once we've put you on Dosadi. Barank visibly came to a decision, nodding to himself. Jedrick expects you. That was the other name Erich's people had provided. Your cell leader. She's been told that you're a new infiltrator from the Rim. Jedrick doesn't know your true origin. Who does know? We cannot tell you. If you don't know, then that information cannot be wrested from you. We assure you, though, that Jedrick isn't one of our people. McKee didn't like the sound of that warning. Wrested from you. As usual, Busab sent you into the tiger's mouth without a full briefing on the length of the tiger's fangs. Barank gestured toward his tracked vehicle. Shall we go? McKee glanced at the machine. It was an obvious war device, heavily armored with slits in its metal cab, projectile weapons protruding at odd angles. It looked squat and deadly. Erich's people had mentioned such things. We saw to it that they got only primitive armored vehicles, projectile weapons, and relatively unimportant explosives, that sort of thing. They've been quite resourceful in their adaptations of such weaponry, however. Once more, Barank gestured toward his vehicle, obviously anxious to leave. McKee was forced to suppress an abrupt feeling of profound anxiety. What had he gotten himself into? He felt that he had awakened to find himself on a terrifying slide into peril, unable to control the least threat. The sensation passed, but it left him shaken. He delayed while he continued to stare at the vehicle. It was about 6 meters long with heavy tracks, plus other wheels faintly visible within the shadows behind the tracks. It sported a conventional antenna at the rear for tapping the power transmitter in orbit beneath the barrier veil, but there was a secondary system which burned a stinking fuel. The smoke of that fuel filled the air around them with acridity. "For what do we wait?" Barank demanded. He glared at McKee with obvious fear and suspicion. "We can go now," McKee said. Barank turned and led the way swiftly, clambering up over the tracks and into a cab. McKee followed, found the interior a tightly cluttered place full of a bitter, oily smell. There were two hard metal seats with curved backs higher than the head of a seated human or Gowichan. Barank already occupied the seat on the left, working switches and dials. McKee dropped into the other seat, folding arms locked across his chest and waist to hold him in place. A bracket fitted itself to the back of his head. Barank threw a switch. The door through which they'd entered closed with a grinding of servo motors and the solid clank of locks. An ambivalent mood swept over McKee. He had always felt faint agoraphobia in open places such as the area around the rock. But the dim interior of this war machine, with its savage reminders of primitive times, touched an atavistic chord in his psyche, and he fought an urge to claw his way outside. This was a trap. An odd observation helped him overcome the sensation. There was glass over the slits which gave them their view of the outside. Glass. He felt it. Yes, glass. It was common stuff in the consentiency. Strong, yet fragile. He could see that this glass wasn't very thick. The fierce appearance of this machine had to be more show than actuality, then. Barank gave one swift, sweeping glance to their surroundings, moved levers which set the vehicle into lurching motion. It emitted a grinding rumble with an overriding whine. A track of sorts led from the white rock toward the distant city. It showed the marks of this machine's recent passage, a roadway to follow. Glittering reflections danced from bright rocks along the track. Barank appeared very busy with whatever he was doing to guide them toward Chu. McKee found his own thoughts returning to the briefings he'd received on Tandalore. "Once you enter Jedrick's cell, you're on your own." Yes, he felt very much alone, his mind a clutter of data which had little relationship to any previous experience. And this planet could die unless he made sense out of that data, plus whatever else he might learn here. Alone. Alone. If Dosadi died, there'd be few sentient watchers. The Caliban's tempokinetic barrier would contain most of that final destructive flare. The Caliban would, in fact, feed upon the released energy. That was one of the things he'd learned from Fannie Mae. One consuming blast, a meal for a Caliban, and Busab would be forced to start anew, and without the most important piece of physical evidence. Dosadi. The machine beneath McKee thundered, rocked and skidded, but always returned to the track which led toward Chu's distant spires. McKee studied the driver covertly. Barank showed uncharacteristic behavior for a Gowichan. More direct. More human. That was it. His Gowachan instincts had been contaminated by contact with humans. Erich was sure to despise that, fear it. Barank drove with a casual expertise, using a complex control system. McKee counted 8 different levers and arms which the Gowachan employed. Some were actuated by knees, others by his head. His hands reached out while an elbow deflected a lever. The war machine responded. Barank spoke presently without taking his attention from driving. "We may come under fire on the second ledge. There was quite a police action down there earlier." McKee stared at him. "I thought we had safe passage through. You Rimmers are always pressing." McKee peered out the slits. Bushes, barren ground, that lonely track they followed. Barank spoke. "You're older than any Rimmer I ever saw before." Erich's people had warned McKee about this as a basic flaw in his cover, the need to conceal the subtle signs of age. They'd provided him with some geriatric assistance and an answer to give when challenged. He used that answer now. "It ages you in a hurry out here." "It must." McKee felt that something in Barank's response eluded him, but dared not pursue this. It was an unproductive exchange. And there was that reference to a police action. McKee knew that the Rim rabble, excluded from Chu, tried periodic raids, most often fruitless. "Barbaric. What excuse did you use to come out here?" McKee asked. Barank shot a probing glance and raised one webbed hand from the controls to indicate a handle in the roof over his head. The handle's purpose was unknown to McKee, and he feared he had already betrayed too much ignorance. But Barank was speaking. "Officially, I'm scouting this area for any hidden surprises the Rimmers may have stored out here. I often do that. Unofficially, everyone thinks I've a secret pond out here full of fertile females." A pond. Not a Gralus. Again, it was a relatively fruitless exchange with hidden undertones. McKee stared silently ahead through a slit. Their dusty track made a slow and wide sweep left, abruptly angled down onto a narrow ledge cut from red rock walls. Barank put them through a series of swift changes in speed. Slow, fast, slow, fast. The red rock walls raced past. McKee peered out and downward on his side. Far below lay jungle verdure, and in the distance, the smoke and spires of Chu. Fluted buildings ranked high over dim background cliffs. The speed changes appeared purposeless to McKee, and the dizzy drop off the cliff on his side filled him with awe. Their narrow ledge hugged the cliff, turning as the cliff turned, now into shadows and now into light. The machine roared and groaned around him. The smell of oil made his stomach heave, and the faraway city seemed little closer than it had from the cliff top, except that it was taller, more mysterious in its smoky obscurity. "Don't expect any real trouble until we reach the first ledge," Barank said. McKee glanced at him. First ledge? Yes, that'd be the first elevation outside the city's walls. The gorge within which Chu had been raised came down to river level in broad steps, each one numbered. Chu had been anchored to island hills and flats where the river slowed and split into many arms, and the hills which had resisted the river were almost solid iron ore, as were many of the flanking ledges. "Glad to get off there," Barank said. Their narrow ledge had turned at right angles away from the cliff onto a broad ramp which descended into great green jungle. The growth enclosed them in abrupt green shadows. McKee, looking out to the side, identified hair fronds and broad leaf ficus, giant spikes of barbed red which he had never seen before. Their track, like the jungle floor, was gray mud. McKee looked from side to side. The growth appeared an almost equal mixture of Terran and Tandalore, interspersed with many strange plants. Sunlight made him blink as they raced out of the overhanging plants onto a plain of tall grass which had been trampled, blasted and burned by recent violence. He saw a pile of wrecked vehicles off to the left, twisted shards of metal with, here and there, a section of track or a wheel aimed at the sky. Some of the wrecks looked similar to the machine in which he now rode. Barunk skirted a blast hole at an angle which gave McKee a view into the hole's depths. Torn bodies lay there. Barunk made no comment, seemed hardly to notice. Abruptly, McKee saw signs of movement in the jungle, the flitting presence of both humans and Gowichan. Some carried what appeared to be small weapons, the glint of a metal tube, bandoliers of bulbous white objects around their necks. McKee had not tried to memorize all of Dosati's weaponry. It was, after all, primitive, but reminded himself now that primitive weapons had created these scenes of destruction. Their track plunged again into overhanging growth, leaving the battlefield behind. Deep green shadows enclosed the lurching, rumbling machine. McKee, shaken from side to side against the restraints, carried an odor memory with him. Deep, bloody musks and the beginnings of rot. Their shaded avenue made a sharp right turn, emerged onto another ledge slashed by a plunging cut into which Barunk took them, turning onto another cliff-hugging ledge. McKee stared across Barunk through the slits. The city was nearer now. Their rocking descent swept his gaze up and down Shu's towers, which lifted like silvery organ pipes out of the council hills. The far cliff was a series of misted steps fading into purple-gray. Chu's warrens lay smoky and hazed all around the fluted towers, and he could make out part of the city's enclosing outer wall. Squat forts dotted the wall's top, offset for enfilading fire. The city within the wall seemed so tall. McKee had not expected it to appear so tall, but that spoke of the population pressures in a way that could not be misunderstood. Their ledge ended at another battlefield plain strewn with bodies of metal and flesh, the death stink and inescapable vapor. Barunk spun his vehicle left, right, dodged piles of torn equipment, avoided craters where mounds of flesh lay beneath insect blankets. Ferns and other low growth were beginning to spring upright after the monstrous trampling. Gray and yellow flying creatures sported in the fern tops, uncaring of all that death. Erich's aides had warned McKee that Dosati's life existed amidst brutal excesses, but the actuality sickened him. He identified both Gowichan and human forms among the sprawled corpses. The sleek green skin of a young Gowichan female, orange fertility marks prominent along her arms, especially revolted him. McKee turned sharply away, found Barunk studying him with tawny mockery in the shining Gowichan eyes. Barunk spoke as he drove. There are informers everywhere, of course. And after this, his head nodded left and right. You'll have to move with more caution than you might have anticipated. A brittle explosion punctuated his words. Something struck the vehicle's armor on McKee's side. Again, they were a target. And again. The clanging of metal against metal came thickly, striking all around them, even on the glass over the view slits. McKee suppressed his shock. That thin glass did not shatter. He knew about thick shields of tempered glass, but this put a new dimension on what he'd been told about the Dosati. Quite resourceful indeed. Barunk drove with apparent unconcern. More explosive attacks came from directly in front of them, flashes of orange in the jungle beyond the plain. They're testing, Barunk said. He pointed to one of the slits. See, they don't even leave a mark on that new glass. McKee spoke from the depths of his bitterness. Sometimes you wonder what all this proves except that our world runs on distrust. Who trusts? Barunk's words had the sound of a catechism. McKee said, I hope our friends know when to stop testing.
They were told we couldn't take more than 80 millimeter.
Didn't they agree to pass us through?
Even so. They're expected to try a few shots, if just to keep me in good graces with my superiors.
Once more, Barunk put them through a series of dazzling speed changes and turns for no apparent reason. McKee lurched against the restraints, felt bruising pain as an elbow hit the side of the cab.
An explosion directly behind rocked them up onto the left track. As they bounced, Baronk spun them left, avoided another blast which would have landed directly on them along their previous path. McKee, his ears ringing from the explosions, felt the machine bounce to a stop, reverse as more explosions erupted ahead. Baronk spun them to the right, then left, once more charged full speed ahead right into an unbroken wall of jungle. With explosions all around, they crashed through greenery, turned to the right along another shadowed muddy track. McKee had lost all sense of direction, but the attack had ceased. Baronk slowed them, took a deep breath through his ventricles. I knew they'd try that. He sounded both relieved and amused. McKee, shaken by the brush with death, couldn't find his voice. Their shadowy track snaked through the jungle for a space, giving McKee time to recover. By then, he didn't know what to say. He couldn't understand Baronk's amusement, the lack of enduring concern over such violent threat. Presently, they emerged onto an untouched sloping plain as smooth and green as a park lawn. It dipped gently downward into a thin screen of growth through which McKee could see a silver-green tracery of river. What caught and held McKee's attention, however, was a windowless, pock-walled gray fortress which lifted from the plain in the middle distance. It towered over the growth screening the river. Buttressed arms reached toward them to enclose a black metal barrier. That's our gate, Baronk said. Baronk turned them left, lined up with the center of the buttressed arms. Gate 9, and we're home through the tube, he said. McKee nodded. Walls, tubes, and gates. Those were the keys to choose defenses. They had barrier and fortress mines on Dosati. This tube would run beneath the river. He tried to place it on the map which Erich's people had planted in his mind. He was supposed to know the geography of this place, its geology, religions, social patterns, the intimate layout of each island's walled defenses. But he found it hard to locate himself now on that mental map. He leaned forward to the slit, peered upward as the machine began to gather speed, saw the great central spire with its horizontal clock. All the hours of map briefing snicked into place. Yes. Gate 9. Baronk, too busy driving, did not reply. McKee dropped his gaze to the fortress, stifled a gasp. The rumbling machine was plunging downslope at a frightening pace, aimed directly toward that black metal barrier. At the last instant, when it seemed they would crash into it, the barrier leaped upward. They shot through into a dimly illuminated tube. The gate thundered closed behind them. Their machine made a racketing sound on metal grating beneath the tracks. Baronk slowed them, shifted a lever beside him. The machine lifted onto wheels with an abrupt reduction in noise, which made McKee feel that he'd been deafened. The feeling was heightened by the realization that Baronk had said the same thing to him several times. Jedrick says you come from beyond the far mountains. Is that true? Jedrick says it. He tried to make it sound wry, but it came out almost questioning. Baronk was concentrating on a line of thought, however, as he drove them straight down the grating floor of the dim tube. There's a rumor that you Rimmers have started a secret settlement back there, that you're trying to build your own city. An interesting rumor, isn't it, though? The single line of overhead lights in the tube left the cab's interior darker than it had been outside, illuminated by only the faint reflections from instruments and dials. But McKee had the odd sensation that Baronk saw him clearly, was studying every expression. Despite the impossibility of this, the thought persisted. What was behind Baronk's probing? Why do I feel that he sees right through me? These disquieting conjectures ended as they emerged from the tube onto a Warren Street. Baronk spun them to the right along a narrow alleyway in deep gray shadows. Although he'd seen many representations of these streets, the actuality deepened McKee's feelings of misgiving. So dirty. Oppressive. So many people. They were everywhere. Baronk drove slowly now on the silent wheels, the tracks raised off the paving. The big machine eased its way through narrow little streets, some paved with stone, some with great slabs of gleaming black. All the streets were shaded by overhanging upper stories whose height McKee could not judge through the slits. He saw shops barred and guarded. An occasional stairway, also guarded, led up or down into repellent darkness. Only humans occupied these streets, and no casual pedestrian expressions on any of them. Jaws were set on grim mouths. Hard, questioning eyes peered at the passing vehicle. Both men and women wore the universal dark one-piece clothing of the labor pool. Noting McKee's interest, Baronk spoke. "This is a human enclave, and you have a Gowichan driver. Can they see us in here?" "They know. And there's trouble coming."
"Trouble?"
"Gowichan against human." This appalled McKee, and he wondered if this were the source of those forebodings which Erich and aides would not explain. Destruction of Dosadi from within. But Baronk continued. "There's a growing separation between humans and Gowichan, worse than it's ever been. You may be the last human to ride with me." Erich and company had prepared McKee for Dosadi's violence, hunger, and distrust, but they'd said nothing about species against species, only that someone they refused to name could destroy the place from within. What was Baronk trying to say? McKee dared not expose his ignorance by probing, and this inability dismayed him. Baronk, meanwhile, nosed their machine out of a narrow passage onto a wider street which was crowded by carts, each piled with greenery. The carts moved aside slowly as the armored vehicle approached, hatred plain in the eyes of the humans who moved with the carts. The press of people astonished McKee. For every cart, and he lost count of them within a block, there were at least 100 people crowding around, lifting arms high, shouting at the ring of people who stood shoulder to shoulder around each cart, their backs to the piled contents, and obviously guarding those contents. McKee, staring at the carts, realized with a shocked sense of recognition that he was staring at carts piled with garbage. The crowds of people were buying garbage. Again, Baronk acted the part of tour guide. "This is called the Street of the Hungry. That's very select garbage. The best." McKee recalled one of Erich's aides saying there were restaurants in Chu which specialized in garbage from particular areas of the city, that no poison-free food was wasted. The passing scene compelled McKee's attention. Hard faces, furtive movements, the hate and thinly suppressed violence, all of this immersed in a normal commercial operation based on garbage. And the numbers of these people. They were everywhere around. In doorways, guarding and pushing the carts, skipping out of Baronk's path. New smells assaulted McKee's nostrils. A fetid acridity. A stink such as he had never before experienced. Another thing surprised him. The appearance of antiquity in this warren. He wondered if all city populations crowded by threats from outside took on this ancient appearance. By consentient standards, the population of Chu had lived here only a few generations, but the city looked older than any he'd ever seen. With an abrupt rocking motion, Baronk turned their machine down a narrow street, brought them to a stop. McKee, looking out the slit on his right, saw an arched entry in a grimy building, a stairway leading downward into gloom. "Down there's where you meet Jedrick," Baronk said. "Down those stairs, second door on your left. It's a restaurant."
"How will I know her?"
"Didn't they tell you?"
"I..."
McKee broke off. He'd seen pictures of Jedrick during the Tandalua briefings, realized now that he was trying to delay leaving Baronk's armored cocoon. Baronk appeared to sense this. "Have no fear, McKee. Jedrick will know you." "And McKee..." McKee turned to face the Gowichan. "Go directly to the restaurant. Take a seat. Wait for Jedrick. You'll not survive long here without her protection. Your skin's dark, and some humans prefer even the green to the dark in this quarter. They remember Pilash Gate here. 15 years isn't long enough to erase that from their minds. Nothing about a Pilash Gate had been included in McKee's briefings, and now he dared not ask. Baronk moved the switch which opened McKee's door. Immediately the stink of the street was amplified to almost overpowering proportions. Baronk, seeing him hesitate, spoke sharply. "Go, quickly!" McKee descended in a kind of olfactory daze, found himself standing on the side of the street, the object of suspicious stares from all around. The sight of Baronk driving away was the cutting of his last link to the consentiency and all the familiar things which might protect him. Never in his long life had McKee felt this much alone.